continuing the interview with Mr. Norris Lineweaver, take number 3.
Okay, so...
Oh, I'm sorry. I paused because I thought you were didn't want to go.
No.
I'll hit the go button again. All right, you're back on the news. You ready?
Okay. All right.
Stand by. Let me.
Yeah. So we've talked about how the Metropolitan Association dealt with Fall Creek members, you know, people who are still members of Fall Creek when the facility closed, or before the facility closed. And we've talked about how Metro dealt with different activist groups, like the Members United to Save Fall Creek. And we've also discussed how you dealt with like the general community. And this was in forms of relocating programs and also in the form of public notices in newspapers.
Where did I put it?
I was just putting it in my pocket.
Sorry.
There you go.
Sorry, I was feeling pretty comfortable without being hooked up.
That would have been a little too mischievous. Huh?
I hope I didn't interrupt your question. Were you at the end of the question?
No.
You were live on mic, but I wasn't, but I was
right.
Irrelevant to
okay.
you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. If I just, let me see.
Stand by. I'm going to press record again. Everybody? Okay, stand by.
Okay, so I rephrased my question. So we've talked about how the Metropolitan Association has dealt with members, has dealt with activist groups, and has dealt with the general Black community.
Yeah.
And this came in forms of relocating programs to serve people who have been members of Fall Creek and also to serve other constituents. And also it came in the form of public notices that were put in newspapers to, you know, tell the public about the truth and about why Fall Creek closed, and to tell the public about why Metro made the decision to close the Fall Creek YMCA. So let's talk about your conversations with reporter, columnist, and community organizer Amos Brown. So Brown is an influential TV and radio host who has supported community-centered initiatives. And his broadcast, Afternoons with Amos, has been described as, quote, the most listened-to talk show among African Americans in Indianapolis. And you've actually been the subject of some of his editorials. And so in a memo to the board of directors dated October 13th, 2003, you commented that Brown's editorial on October 10th, 2003 demonstrated that you had, and I'm quoting you, fallen off his prospect list for Demon of the Year, close quote. So I just wanted to know, why did you think that Brown had perceived you as, you know, as the bad guy in this whole process of closing Fall Creek?
Well,
I
tried not to take it personally, but I understood that it's something that not only Amos Brown but others had to do in order to get a message across. And I think it was a reflection of lack of trust. I mean, as the CEO, I carry that mantle of total responsibility for that decision. And there was no place else for me to pass the buck, even if I tried. You know, the price to be paid, the biggest price that was paid, by the way, were people who were disappointed that an institution that meant a great deal to them was being closed. The price I paid personally was by virtue of my position, and I understood that. And I was forewarned in advance that I would be subjected to unkind words, attacking my character and so forth. I've been there before. I mean, I spent the better part of my career advancing the YMCA's mission in populations and in the inner city and around the world in places where the Y initially might not have been immediately welcomed. But the need was there. And once we began to demonstrate meeting needs successfully, then the controversy began to fade. And so a decision was made, and there was a lack of trust in certain quarters of the community that we were operating on truth, and that we had made a decision with the best interest of the community at heart. And so there were people who perceived that we made a decision cold and uncaring towards the community served by Fall Creek and totally ignoring other efforts that we were making in the community that was getting greater success in serving African-American community in, our constituents in particular. And so I realized that I was responding to a controversy based upon the history and legacy of the Senate Avenue YMCA, to a certain degree, Fall Creek. I was absolutely the not the right person to speak with pride about the Senate Avenue Y. That had to come from other people, although I personally was very intrigued and very proud of the history of the Senate Avenue Y, and wanted to do everything I could to preserve that legacy and make sure it doesn't fall through the cracks. So we, on the one hand, we had our facts very focused that led us to make this decision based on our internal facts that we had direct control over in terms of the finances and so forth, and also paying attention to secondary data from the outside in terms of what was happening in the community. So we had the facts over here, but we also had our eye and ear in particular on the emotions of the community. And loss is, there's different responses to what it means to lose something that you thought you had. And who's in control of making that decision when it feels personal to people. And so I understood the controversy, and I understood that there are people who had to show up and represent those who felt that pain and that loss. And there were some who were very responsible and paying attention to the facts at hand of what was happening in the community, and others who were just listening to the emotions. Amos Brown, are we ready to go with my interviews with Amos Brown? Mm-hmm. Amos Brown is someone who does his homework. Mm-hmm. And what he does with me off camera is no comparison to what he did in writing and on camera with me on the interviews. I mean, I was very stimulated by our interviews on camera during his show, but I tell you, if the camera is on before the show, I mean, he ripped me from head to toe, and I thought, wow, this is not going to be a very good interview. But once we were on camera, he was very professional, asked me the tough questions and follow-up questions to the answers I made. He held me accountable, but he did his homework. He showed up at he was there at the studio before I was, and he was ready for me. There were a couple other media contacts that I followed up with where the host didn't even show up until it was ready to go on air, and didn't even know what my name was and why I was even there. Amos Brown is a professional, and I regard him with the highest respect, and arguably, I believe, one of the best reporters and journalists in our community. As for the demonizing in the columns that was a part of his writing, that was the first step. And when I wrote that piece, I didn't call Amos, am I off your list yet? I just felt like that there was a shift taking place. When I was at Murder Row with all the clergy and other black leaders in the community, who that was an awful meeting. Not so much in terms of what was happening to me. Amos Brown was there, but Amos Brown listened, and he was taking notes. He was taking notes while I was speaking. He was taking notes of other people in that conversation. But he did not confront me in that meeting. And again, that's another measure of respect I have for him. He had his opportunities to lean in on me when it was his turf and his show. But when he was there in the presence of peers and being convened by others in the room, his respect was for people around that table. And I observed that, and I made a note of that. He did not confront me in that meeting. He didn't have to, because he already had done that. And I have nothing but the highest respect for Amos. You know, you have to look at You know, Amos came from Chicago. You know, he had aspirations of living in certain neighborhoods here in Indianapolis, and he was turned away. And that's, and he had a rather, you know, surprising entry into this community. He wasn't doing anything any differently than he would have in his hometown in Chicago. But he found things that were different here in Indianapolis. And I think because of those personal experiences, and in addition to the fact that he's a very professional journalist, he set about to commit himself to be a part of change, moving in a new direction and something positive for the community. So I, to this day, have nothing but the greatest respect for Amos Brown. And as we began to meet each other on incidental occasions, like at Black Expo and so forth, we greeted each other as men and friends, and in a sense, colleagues, if you will. But I still would expect that if Amos Brown were interviewing me right now, he would have done his homework, and he would have kept my feet to the fire in terms of things I said 10 years ago or whatever. Yeah, it'd be almost 10 years ago, and what has happened to this day, and he would have done his homework about what has happened as a result of decisions we made back then, and did we honor the commitments we made back then. And I would expect it to be held accountable, and I'm inspired by that. I'm stimulated by it. He was the most credible reporter of anyone in the media that I dealt with during that time of controversy.
Mm-hmm. And so his October 10th editorial came out after he had you as a guest on his WDNI program.
Mm-hmm.
And in that October 10th editorial, he describes your communication with him as, quote, a positive step in the right direction, close quote. And so the tone of his editorial was really shifted after you both sat down and talked, and after he interviewed you on his show. So it seems like he...
Well, you remember his show format is that there's that his own intro, and then a question and answer with his guest, and then he opens up to call-ins.
Right.
And so it's not just me responding to Amos, but also call-ins.
Right.
And people calling from the community. Again, I was stimulated by that, and I hope that I demonstrated my knowledge of the community, as limited as it was, but that I answered forthrightly and didn't shy away from the most embarrassing questions. It was not an easy time for me. I don't want any air of confidence I might have displayed on camera at that time. Inside, I had butterflies in my stomach, and I wanted to show up for the community first and the YMCA second. And I realized that a lot of responsibility was on my shoulder at that time, but you know, there was a lot of responsibility on Amos's shoulder too. And I think both of us were trying to do the right thing for people that we felt like we were reaching out to. More so for Amos than for me. He had a huge, tremendous knowledge of the issues facing the community and what this decision represented. It was bigger than the YMCA. That was the point. It was bigger than the YMCA.
So let's talk about actually selling the property after it's closed in September 2003. The Metropolitan Association sold the Fall Creek YMCA facility to Center Township trustee Carl L. Drummer for the sum of $1,500,000. And you've talked about what that sum of money was used for. It was split in half. So one half of it went to an endowment for children and youth programs. And the other half of the proceeds went to building Pike Township, Pike Township's Y. So how did the Metro come up with the sum?
That decision?
Right.
Had it come up with the sum?
Yeah, to sell.
We retained, before making the decision, you know, being good stewards of a asset, we had a book value in our balance sheet based on what it cost to construct, you know, back in 1958. That was a book value. But we really didn't know what the market value was. And before we entered into any serious decision making, we felt like we needed an objective appraisal of that. And so we retained Integra Real Estate Appraisal to go in and conduct a, an appraisal. And, you know, as appraisals go, they come up with a low value, middle value, and a high value. You know, it's again, the market value is in the eyes of the beholder, a buyer and a seller. So we took the middle value, not the highest, not the lowest, but the middle. That was $1.5 million. And as real estate appraisals are conducted, I'm not an expert in that field, but they compare to other properties qualifying in terms of which the nature of that property is, and if there were any commercial sales within a certain radius, what were those values showing up? And then projecting some of the improvements that were taking place and investments that were taking place in the surrounding neighborhood, and then assessing a value. So that's how we came up with that. You know, I had direct conversations with trustees of Center Township. Carl Drummer was in the behind the scenes, but I knew that he was very much involved. And the key principle in working with that particular stage, Lacey Johnson was a trustee at that time. And there were some negotiations and talk about why would we select Center Township if they're bidding on the property. We had other bids, by the
right.
way.
Mm-hmm.
And we selected Center Township because we felt like that was the best opportunity to place the asset in continued service to the community in which Fall Creek Y was designed to meet. And the understanding at the time was that they would use their, one of the things that was a challenge to the Y is that we couldn't get up the totem pole on what's called housing credits, tax credits. That, you know, when new development was taking place and it was displacing housing, the developer had to fund tax credits in order to help facilitate replacement housing elsewhere. And so because we were SRO, single resident occupancy housing, theoretically, we were eligible to tap that to make the improvements for the residents. But we were so low on the totem pole that for us to get there would take us forever. That was one of the reasons we took that trip to Columbus, Ohio, is because they had a similar tax incentive program for redevelopment of SRO housing. And when we came back, we began to realize that the prospects of that was difficult. And so we even talked about a partnership with Frank Hageman, who was probably at that time one of the leading advocates and a resource that was actually improving SRO housing in Center Township. And we talked about a potential partnership with him before we even talked about closing the residence. Mm-hmm. And even Frank said to us that, you know, 99 keys is not that exciting. And the cost of doing the renovations and so forth and place it in affordable housing, the capitalization cost would far exceed the return on investment. So Center Township was really the most viable bid, and I was very excited about it. And I thought, well, if there's anybody who could demonstrate how that location might have a chance to serve the needs of the community, it would be Center Township. And so, but before that decision was made, the board had declared that half of the proceeds of that sale would go for children and youth services in Center Township, not just an open check to anywhere, but to Center Township. And then the other half would go to help finance moving towards the development of a permanent YMCA home in Pike Township. Why? Two-thirds of the membership of the Fall Creek Y came from Pike Township. And that's where those assets went. And people were concerned about, you know, what are we going to do with the proceeds of sale? Every property, every major property, including the downtown Y, half of the land that was owned by the Ruth Lilly Outdoor Center, the Flat Rock YMCA, when the, any proceeds of sale of those properties went into the endowment to fund continued services of that branch or geographic location.
All right, so we're at the end of the interview, and I just want to, as a last point, just talk about the YMCA in sociological terms. So the structure of the YMCA in relation to its branches has been evaluated, in particular by the sociologist Mayer N. Zog. And so I want to talk about a little bit about his research, and I wanted to get, you know, what you thought of his research. What did you thought of, what would you think of a sociologist's appraisal of the YMCA or evaluation of the YMCA?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mayer Zog was a research at University of Chicago, mm-hmm. and his subtitle was the Economy of the YMCA. Mm-hmm. And he traced the history of the YMCA movement in terms of its earlier history. It was very insightful. The shifts of the YMCA moving from a Protestant Christian evangelical to being more ecumenical, and also its early history in being the first meeting place for unions. When unions were being organized, the Y hosted those meetings. And he began to realize that there were changes taking place within the culture of the Y that were attributed to its economic ability to be viable. And so there was decisions made that we had to move away from looking like a church to becoming more interdenominational and ecumenical and retaining our Christian heritage, but moving into more aggressively into what we would call secular programming. So we moved away from the evangelical revival tents. We'd set up huge circus tents, and hundreds of people would come for a revival in the days of Dwight Moody and Billy Sunday and so forth, and to becoming more proactive in promoting the spirit, mind, and body programs that became the precursor to establishing community colleges. We were centers of adult education, and that was replaced eventually by community colleges. The education programs at the inner city in Boston became Northeastern University. And so we evolved over time, and in the meantime, health and physical education became a major emphasis, as there was a great deal more interest after World War II, personal fitness and so forth. And the Y had pioneered a lot of the innovations that are still in practice, and not only Y's, but commercial fitness centers and so forth. I mean, we invented the concept of the Nautilus Cam. We just didn't take our money and invest in it to become a sideline business. We left that to the entrepreneurs. And so there became this emergence of the economy of the YMCA is what he addressed. And how did that influence the culture of the YMCA? And if you read Bowling Along, which is another approach to where Y's were centers of civic engagement, political discussion and debates, especially during the 30s. And that began to change. But it wasn't about the Y changing as much as the community changing in terms of where they wanted to carry the debates in colleges, universities, establishing larger spaces for community engagement took the place of the Y. So the Y had to evolve and change with the market and develop our expertise in other areas. And so health and physical education became a major part of our story, aquatics. And but we also continued our work. The biggest change, talking about the economy of the YMCA, is that more than a fourth of our program enrollment and income comes now from child care, which you couldn't find in the YMCA prior to the 70s. And so that was a major change. And difficult to even have a child care center as such at Fall Creek because of the way the building was designed, and really forced Fall Creek to look at the after school program away from the Y. And that was something new and different for them. And they did. But the overhead of the building, the cost of operating that building makes it difficult to be aggressive in taking your subsidies and funding programs and outreach when you have immediate demands of keeping the building open.
And just for a quick bio on Professor Zoll, just to have it on record, he's currently Professor Emeritus of Social Work at the University of Michigan. And he has earned various distinctions for his research and writings in various fields, including organizational studies and social theory. So he's preeminent in his field.
Mayor Zoll. Yeah, and at the time, I think his book was actually his dissertation at the University of Chicago, and it came out in the 70s, I believe.
Right, organizational change, the political economy of the YMCA. And so lastly, I just want to talk about one of the characteristics of the YMCA, which allowed it to evolve in the ways that you've just discussed. So according to Zoll, one of the main characteristics of the Y is its enrollment economy, which you've really just been describing.
Yeah.
Or it's basically the Y's dependence on a fee-paying clientele.
Yes.
So the conventional Y is funded by membership fees or is financed by members who pay for activities and services. So you agree that it has this kind of structure?
Yeah, in fact, to this day, I would say I think a common statistic nationwide, at least 85% the budget of the Y comes from enrollment fees, whether it be program participation or membership.
But the Y's enrollment economy has quote unquote the defect of its virtues, and that's one of the things that Zoll also talks about in his 1963 article, From Evangelism to General Service, The Transformation of the YMCA.
Yeah.
He explained that the Y's enrollment economy not only contributed to its modification of services throughout time, it not only contributed to its evolution, but also ironically constrained branches to replace evangelistic and community programs with financially solvent recreational activities. So in short, YMCA branches become self-financing through the support of members, and so it's necessary to offer activities that attract fee-paying members. And in his book, Organizational Change, Zoll talks about how, I'm going to quote him, because of the Y's business-like economy, it has often turned away from areas of need which cannot be met within its framework, close quote, or basically which cannot support a local YMCA with membership fees. So you agree with Zoll's description of the Y's having an enrollment economy.
That's a major influence of our current culture.
Okay.
And earlier in our discussion, we talked about social capital.
Right.
That social capital, that enrollment economy existed at one point in time. That was Senate Avenue YMCA at its very best. And then when changes started taking place in the community, we talked about the inter-district desegregation order, opened up eventually housing outside of Center Township. That social capital made a decision to enroll elsewhere, and they took their children to what they perceived to be better opportunities for education. Whether we like that or accept that, that's another discussion. That's, again, the perception of acknowledging the reality of what happened and how that had its impact on the Y. Now, for the Y to then make a major strategic commitment to serve populations that are not best served by an enrollment economy, we have to change the structure of the program. And we recognize that here in Indianapolis, and that's why we created the Urban Mission Branch. And it's different from other branches in that it has no assigned service territory. It can go anywhere where there's a human need that cannot respond in the traditional notions of the enrollment economy. In other words, we're going to have to structure admission into the program differently. And the best way to do that is to be there, be present in that community where we don't have to rely upon as much of the social capital that may or may not be present. We can capture the children because they're at school already. And so we don't have to depend on parent enrollment to enroll them. We can contact the children first and bring in the parents later, which is our strategy. And until the parents become comfortable with who we are and what we're doing with their children. And so it requires a very different approach, different strategy, different sources of income. And so I would say that instead of the United Way just simply subsidizing YMCAs, we're taking that United Way support to undergird and subsidize a very different structure of programming in the community that doesn't depend as much on initiative from parents to enroll their children. And so that's what, in effect, we began to realize in order to diversify our income and stabilize the future direction of the Y, we had to diversify. So outside of that enrollment economy are other initiatives that we approach very aggressively with the United Way, with government, and our commitment here at one time, I think it still is, we will never accept more than 10% of our total budget from government sources, because it's not a very reliable long-term source of revenue. So we put a cap on it so that we can control stability and secure the future. And then we take the United Way funds and contributed dollars to match the dollars we're receiving from the government to serve communities that are not going to be as responsive to the enrollment economy. But that doesn't mean we're going to isolate those program centers from our main branches, because some of those subsidies go to branches who have one participation of constituents in their community that traditionally have not been able to join the Y in this enrollment economy. So in effect, we're affecting change of culture in our branches that rely heavily on the enrollment economy, but we want to diversify their thinking, to think different, in reaching out to communities who otherwise probably wouldn't take that stance. I mean, our commitment to right now in prevention of diabetes, that is not a racial issue. It affects everybody. But there's a very strong evidence. In fact, in my meetings with people in the community about Fall Creek, I would ask them, what is it about you that has this passion about why Fall Creek is important to you? And then they would open up and say, I've been given a death sentence by my doctor. I have to have a place to go work out because I have diabetes. And that struck that hit me pretty hard. I mean, that goes right down to, you know, boy, I mean, this is a serious decision we're making. Now, the people I talked to had the means to go to, otherwise they weren't that much further away to continue their program. But we had no program at that time that directly addressed prevention of diabetes. And that's what led us to have this conversation with IU Medical. And now as a national program, prevention of diabetes came as a result of my personal interviews with people I talked to about Fall Creek and why it was important to them. That led the question for us to move in that direction. And so if we're not changing, we're falling back. We have to constantly change to meet the needs of the community. And yes, sometimes we can get so focused on the enrollment economy that we lose sight of people we're missing. And we have to be always intentional about taking steps to be sure that there are other opportunities in which we can serve people better by changing the way in which we engage them.
And so was the Fall Creek YMCA really the beginning of that change, the beginning of decentralizing?
Before the decision to close Fall Creek, we knew we had to show up differently in the community. And actually, the discussion to create Urban Mission was long before we made the decision about Fall Creek. And 42nd and College was a discussion I entered into very quickly because the board wanted me to go there and work that through, where I began to realize that capitalizing a building to be more located in the inner city was very expensive, and one in which major philanthropists were reticent to go to because of our handling of Fall Creek at that time. I mean, it was very difficult for us to even have a conversation with a major donor in the community without them asking first, what are you going to do about Fall Creek? And so it wasn't about what we're going to do about Fall Creek. It was about, in my opinion, what we're going to do in terms of our commitment to Center Township. And if Fall Creek is going to get in our way, then we had to address Fall Creek. But it wasn't just about closing Fall Creek, it's what then is our role and how are we going to fulfill that in Center Township.
So at the beginning of this interview, I asked you about the goals that you, or really the Metropolitan Board, wanted to accomplish.
Yeah.
So do you feel that you accomplished these goals considering the difficulties of institutional racism and the close of Fall Creek?
Well, you know, how do you measure that? I think there were some proactive measures that as a result of our work with the United Way and with the board in terms of how do we measure success. Mm-hmm. And we had some immediate ways of doing that and pat ourselves on the back and say, you know, we did some good. I mean, we tripled the budget during my watch. We almost tripled the endowment if it weren't for 9/11 and other factors in the economy. And we made more sustainable subsidies in perpetuity to enable our work in the inner city to do long-term decision-making that says we're committed to this in the long term, not just because a government grant's here for 2 years. That's very important. So I think we accomplished a change in the culture. We accomplished a change in the structure by which we had opportunities to make decisions differently than we did when I first came in. But I don't pat myself on the back. This is a decision that were being made by board members at the association level. By the way, we call it the association office, not the metropolitan office. Or I don't know if that's changed, but I mean, there was a reason for that. So I think it opened up just a lot of opportunities. The expansion into communities of wealth enabled us to earn surplus that stabilized the corporate umbrella to be more aggressive and more bold. And not just the inner city, look, there are pockets of poverty and people who are suffering financially in all sectors of our community. But we don't let that be our answer in terms of, are we doing enough in Center Township? No. Would we ever do enough in Center Township? I don't think so. It's just constantly before us, and it's that we have to be committed to do better and do more. How do we evaluate ourselves? The donors tell us how they want us to evaluate, and we answer to those concerns. The board has measures of performance. We have measures of performance with all of our branch operations, and they're measured every day. You know, our finances, I don't know what they are today, but the cost centers that we have that we measure every day financially is in the hundreds. Individual cost centers that enable us to, as just one indicator of success. I mean, we don't hold every cost center to the same standard of success because we understand that we make commitments in certain areas that are not going to measure up and be compared to communities where we should be making home runs every day financially. But we don't want to take an attitude that just because a community cannot measure up to the enrollment economy, that they're less than anyone else, that parents of those children in that swim class expect anything less than what we do for parents who are paying the full freight. Our commitment is that that kid in the inner city is going to get the same level of quality swim instruction as any kid out in the suburbs. Why? Because we know how to do it. Number one, because we do it. But it's a commitment to make sure that we have no excuses to do any less of a quality program in the inner city as we would do anywhere else when parents are very involved looking over our shoulder to see how we're doing. But, you know, you can't always expect that necessarily in the inner city because parents are either taking care of other kids at home or working, struggling. There's a greater disproportionate population of single working parent moms in the inner city than anywhere most of the other areas of the community. So we have to assume a greater responsibility for the care and nurturing those kids entrusted to our care.
Well, we've been talking for about 2 hours and 40 minutes, so I'm just going to let that be the last words. I like how that finalizes the theme of commitment that's really went through the whole interview. So thank you so much for agreeing to sit with me, Mr. Lineweaver, for all of your really eloquent questions and very informational answers. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your commitment to restore the history.
Thank you. I'm going to go off live now.